Through card altering, players and artists have found a way to further the artistic depth of Magic the Gathering and add a level of customization that goes beyond deck building, or even sleeves and playmats. But our guest today, Cthulhu Cards, is about to show us that Magic's art is no longer confined simply to the 2D realm of a card frame. Welcome to Magic the Flavoring, the Magic the Gathering podcast, where we talk about all things Magic flavor design and lore. I'm your host, Andy Mann.
Hello, this is Nathan Cancel.
And today we have a very special guest on the show. We have Keith Brown, also known as Cthulhu Cards. Hi, Keith. How's it going?
Hello. How are you both?
Not too bad. Thank you very much.
Very well, thank you.
So we've got you on the show today to talk about predominantly your card altering and all the different sort of 3D alters, 3D art alters that you produce. Is that the term for them, 3D art alters? How would you describe it?
People call them a bunch of different things depending on what community you're in. But yeah, here in Magic the Gathering, we call them 3D alters because we like to be fancy about things, I guess.
Yeah, sure. Well, okay, 3D alters. That's probably what we go with as well. For anyone who's listening, if you can hear a really weird, like, high-pitched whine in the back of one of our audios, it's because Nathan has a rogue leaf blower outside of his window. Have you shouted at him yet, Nathan?
Well, it's not rogue. I mean, it's manned. If it was a rogue leaf blower, then it would be a bit more of an issue. Because it's just
Yeah.
No, I've got, yeah, for some reason they decided to be very astute with the fact that the wind blew for like 10 minutes earlier and they're already out there with the leaf blowers. But they should be done soon, I'm hoping. I'm just going to be quieter than normal. So you get less wine from that and less wine from me.
Oh, well, wouldn't that be a treat? so the wind's been kicked up for, like, what, literally a day? Like, we've only just hit autumn in the UK, and this goon's got already out with his leaf blower.
Within seconds.
How's the back end of October treating you over in the US? Whereabouts are you, Keith?
I'm located in Utah, just at the nestled in the corner of the Rocky Mountains. So we've gotten a bit of snow, not right where I live. I'm a little bit further down into the valley, but my parents had about an inch of snow last Sunday. And
oh, really?
It's been extremely cold ever since then. We've just been waiting for the next winter storm ever since.
That's crazy. Like, is that usual for this time of year?
On and off. Utah's a strange place. We don't have autumn. We have summer and winter. And then between the two, we don't have spring or autumn. We just have an interval, just a roller coaster between winter and summer until one of them wins. And
I mean, that doesn't sound dissimilar to the UK.
Yeah, no, I feel you. Actually, the years as I've grown older, and the years have gone by in my life. I feel like it gets that you don't really get the slow descent anymore. It's one day you're like, oh, actually, you know what? It's t-shirt weather, and then halfway through you get knocked for six with some gale force winds. So, yeah, it's a win.
I'm so sorry, Nathan. That leaf blower in the background is just utterly hilarious. It sounds like someone playing bagpipes.
So with my headphones, that is genuinely how it sounds like to me, because for some reason I have, you know, a cultural swing to me. If you want to hear music in leaf blowers, Andy, that is entirely your prerogative.
I mean, yeah, sure. You gotta find some joy in it. So before we get on to talking about the 3D card alters, I kind of feel it's kind of cool to know your relationship to Magic, Keith. Like, you're a big EDH player, as we know, because we, the three of us and one of mine and Nathan's friends from RLGS, played a game of video EDH across Spelltable not but a week ago. And yeah, your decks are pretty special, dude. Like, do you want to talk about your relationship to EDH and kind of where you're at and where your build philosophies are?
Absolutely, yeah. I kind of got started in Magic in my 20s, I would say. I had a couple of encounters with it before that, but that was kind of when I really got into it. And I almost immediately latched onto EDH as my method of play that I would prefer, and kind of can't really stand any other way of playing it. I just don't like 1v1. But it was funny. When I first kind of got back into the game when I was about around 22, I was at NLGS, and the person at the shop at the cash register who was helping me kind of pick out what I wanted to do asked me a couple of questions about how I like to play other games, and he said, "Oh, well, you're going to play Commander."
Nice. Well, that's really cool. Like, yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it, where for a lot of people who kind of maybe got into the game, maybe even just like 5 or 6 years ago, before it became like this kind of staple format, it was always like a friend kind of going, "Oh, hey, did you know there's this really crazy thing?" I mean, like, as evidenced by Nathan, you're the one who got me into playing EDH, and I really pushed back on it like for like a good sort of 2 or 3 months, because I was going, "But what, you play with 100 cards and you're not quite sure what's going to happen? That sounds stupid." And then you gave me a couple of cards, a couple of decks as a loner, and we spent about 50 hours across 1 week just playing EDH nonstop.
Oh, and yeah.
Yeah, like, yeah. I mean, yeah, that's, and then I was hooked. So, yeah, yeah, I can definitely sort of see that.
Yeah, we did it obviously in a 1v1 kind of format. But by that point, I had an extensive list of decks, and I needed gerbils to be testing these on and against, and with, obviously more with than against.
But, yeah. I remember one of the first decks you gave me, just as a kind of, here you go. And up until this point, I was really only playing like 60 card like kitchen table decks with you and with some of our friends from university. You gave me a rune deck, Rune of the Hidden Realms.
Oh, I gotcha.
As like one of my first decks to kind of just have a go with. And yeah, like ridiculous. But one of the decks that you pulled out against us, Keith, the other night, and this really speaks volumes to me as the kind of player that you are. I mean, just kind of your philosophy. You pulled out a Count Von Doom deck, which is one of the Uncommanders.
I'm going to have to correct you because everybody does this, but it's Baron Von Count.
Baron Von Count. Did I say Count Von Doom?
Yes, you did. And it's fabulous, and it's perfect for the theme of the deck, but but yes.
Oh my God. Well, I'm a fake Magic player, aren't I? So there we go. I've just been showing. All right. Yeah, cool. So yeah, you pulled this deck out, and it's an undeck, and I don't think many players in the sort of casual EDH community really cares about Uncommanders being a thing, but it's always interesting to see them because you don't really see them often in the wild, and it was so much fun. And also, the commander was one of your 3D altars. Like, you have a Baron Von Count like commander 3D altar, which was pretty special. Like, what came first? Did the card come first, or did the altar come first? Did the deck come first, or did the altar come first?
The altar was in progress as I built the deck. I spent most of my time while building the 3D altar just kind of theory crafting the way that I would want to build the deck around this amazing card. But when the spoilers for Unstable first started coming out, I saw Baron Von Count and almost immediately knew that I wanted to build a commander deck around this guy. It just kind of took a while for me to figure out exactly what I wanted to make it like. It was interesting. When the card first was spoiled, almost overnight, everybody knew what the best cards to put into a Baron Von Count commander deck would be. Sure. And I saw that list on Twitter. I was scrolling through Twitter, and a bunch of people were sharing like, "Oh, these are all of the cards that you would put in the Baron Von Count deck." Later on, I believe Command Zone and a couple of other places also listed off all of the best, you know, 2 or 1 CMC cards with all 5 numbers in their text boxes, power, toughness, etc. And I just looked at those lists and I said, "This is so boring. It has no feeling. It has no love of anything really, other than just optimization and efficiency." And I mean, hey, if somebody likes that, I'm not going to yuck their yum by any means, but I couldn't bring myself to play that way. I had a few optimized decks at the time. I already knew how I felt playing those, and it just felt, I don't know, I always got the feeling that whenever I would try to play a deck that was really tuned or optimized, I wanted to win a lot more during those games, and I felt saltier whenever I would lose. And I didn't like the way that made me feel. It made me feel like I was being a bad friend. It made me feel like I was just not being very gracious to my hosts or the other people that were in the game with me. Like, I invited you all over to my home and now I'm just going to get upset because I didn't get to win. Didn't feel good to me. And I wanted to try to find something that would kind of spark a different way of enjoying the game. And so I came up with this Baron Von Count deck, and that was kind of the start of my journey into this way that I build decks now that I absolutely love.
Fantastic. I mean, it is the kind of thing where, since we've been sort of interviewing like artists such as yourself that are kind of affiliated with the game, or, you know, creatives who also play Magic, there's definitely this sense of, you know, wanting to treat it as many EDH players treat it, and indeed many Magic players in any format, where it is as something, I think, Nathan, you said in the past, it's an intellectual exercise. It's flexing the creative muscles in a way that is strategically viable, and it kind of meets up these two worlds. So I think that's definitely a place where you seem to live. We'll keep going with this deck as like the kind of case study. How did you inject yourself into this deck without having to worry about optimization?
Well, I kind of built my own limitations around what I wanted to do. One of my favorite movies has been, for a very long time, Megamind. And I just love the bombastic, over-the-top supervillain style. The James Bond films, for all of their, I would say, problems, are...
Insensitivities,
yes, I'll put it that way, are absolutely fabulous, just romps through supervillainy and super spydom and all of that. And I just love all of that way over the top, larger than life hero versus villain. And I wanted... The way that I always describe it now is... If Baron Von Count was building this commander deck, what would he put in the commander deck? He would not try to make this the most efficient machine that he possibly could. He would go with style. He would go with something that felt like a supervillain. So I put together the deck referencing cards that all felt or evoked some kind of sense of being a supervillain, like being Megamind or being a Bond villain. So it has a bunch of cards in it, like Scuttling Doom Engine or Imminent Doom or Hero's Demise or Humble Defector, because every supervillain needs a good defector to go to the good guys team.
See, I love this idea of as you're like tinkering on the card, making the card, you're also like, you know, in that scene, like where the evil villains like they all mocked me. They're all telling me to use all the low converted mana costs. And you're going, no, I'll show them as you're literally constructing.
Right.
Pretending to.
Yeah.
That's such an amazing scene in my head.
The scheming spite moment where you're like, I'll show them. Fantastic. You are literally a supervillain as you're making the deck, which, you know, there's an element of role-playing Magic, which that's I think we all need to embrace. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I don't know if you saw on Twitter, because I only put it out in the last couple of days. I was on Tap That MTG's Twitch channel the other day playing some EDH with a brand new deck that was inspired by your choice to use an Uncommander, Keith. I very hastily built a Pippa Duchess of Dice deck. So it's the green blue Simic dice rolling one, where the dice that you roll literally become the tokens that you then use, and the power and toughness is their dice roll. And that was directly influenced by you busting out the Baron Von Count deck against us. I mean, it was a trip, because Nathan, you've had an Uncommander before. You had X for a long time.
Yeah. I specifically did what you did, which I found a commander that literally spoke to me immediately. I mean, I don't know what it says about me that I like stealing people.
You like X.
But as soon as I saw this amazing Super Spy that comes into your hand and emulates your, and does, because I love steal effects, I like emulation effects, things like Notion Thief.
Notion Thief.
And the new spoiler, for example, the one which stops your opponents from searching, and you go and search for them. These kinds of effects. So I built a deck from scratch. It was one of the first ones that I did for like an entire list of going through, and I not only wanted it to feel like thievier, but I wanted it to feel like super dim. It was like most dimmer agent. And I still have a Scarab God deck that does the same kind of thing. Now it's more of a I steal it out of your graveyard. It feels thematically significantly worse, but ain't no one out there wanting to play against the next deck. So I have to admit too, but yeah, same idea. This is what Unstable is amazing for, because it just gave so many amazing ideas that you could then completely and utterly express through cards. And obviously throughout Magic, there's been such a wide array of words, of actions, of people that you can kind of fit in, that, yeah, you can kind of really go deep on it if you're willing to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and the limitations that you were talking about with your deck, Keith, like the idea of you don't want to optimize it, you don't want to kind of push it to its limits, you want it to have a character rather than just being like a cold sort of, you know, damage-dealing machine, is definitely an ethos that I took. I mean, I think I have it in most of my decks, but I fear that maybe I do try and sort of optimize a lot of my decks more than they should do. But for this one, I definitely took that philosophy from your deck and put it into my Pippa one, because while she has, there is tap on tap synergies, and there's, you know, you can make the tokens and then there's token synergies. Simic, just as a color, tends to have the ability to go nuts, especially with producing mana. So yeah. I could easily just do infinite mana, infinite untaps, make infinite tokens win. But that just didn't seem interesting to me. So instead I pulled back and I made sure I pumped as many of the silver bordered dice rolling cards in there. And then I went for tap on tap synergies that were more like Prodigal Sorcerer, just like pinging for one, just doing kind of slightly lukewarm stuff, but that's interesting. And then I made sure that with the other spells in the deck, I didn't just do regular Simic, just, you know, good stuff. I tried to limit myself thematically. So I thought, well, the Pippa Duchess of Dice is very loosely based, it looks like visually, off of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland and Alice Through the Looking Glass, the idea of the Red Queen. And so that those books have a lot of ideas about transformation and kind of growing big and small and transforming into other things. So all of the other cards in the deck are about like polymorphism, and, you know, so you have like Polymorphous Jest, Mass Polymorph, like Rapid Hybridization, Snake Form, all these things that can kind of, you know, boom, like your creature's a snake, boom, your creature's a frog. Yeah. So it was definitely inspired very heavily by your deck building. And I think I can definitely see this kind of love of, you know, I don't know, creative warmth. Is that a bit too wanky to say? Nathan,
yeah, that's very wanky. It's fine.
I'll agree completely, but still say that I love it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I can see that in your deck building as well as your work, because I'm looking down the list of, you have a Twitter thread on your Twitter, obviously, mm-hmm. which is where it would be, as it's a Twitter thread.
it's the pinned tweet on my profile.
It's the pinned tweet. Yeah, which has all of the card alters that you've done. Or I suppose, is it all of them, or is it just the kind of lion's share of them?
No, it is. It's not all of the 2D alters that I originally got started doing, but it is all of the 3D alters I've ever done. I haven't actually done all that many of them, to be honest.
Sure, but I mean, as looking up and down the list and looking at all the different sort of photos of each one, and especially like some of the kind of in progress shots that you do where you're still layering up and doing your work, you can see that creative warmth in what you're doing. I mean, let's talk about that. Let's talk about your work. So you say that you actually started doing 2D alters as opposed to the 3D ones we see you doing today. Is that right?
I did. I have a lot of experience since I was a kid. My mom was an artist for a long time. She went to art school and didn't quite get too far into it, but I was surrounded by art supplies and evidence of art for most of my childhood, and that kind of I suppose that influenced me a bit. Through high school, I'm not sure if that's the same term that you would use, but through most of high school before I went to college, I had some extracurricular advanced level fine arts classes that I took after school, and they were with a local artist in her studio at her home, and I learned quite a lot of fine art media, mostly with oils, but also with acrylics. Charcoal was my favorite medium by far, but I love 2D fine art, hands-on painting. I could never really get involved in the digital art aspect of art, and that's where most profitable artwork could thrive. as a career these days. So I knew that I wouldn't be able to do this as a career by any means, but I still loved it and wanted to keep it as a hobby. Trouble is that most fine art styles take up a lot of space, and I'm not the wealthiest person by any means and don't exactly have a whole lot of space to put a whole art studio in. And so I have to keep things pretty small. Mm-hmm. I did music as my creative outlet for a long time. I played oboe a lot, and that's actually what I went to college for, was music performance. Oh, wow. So I've just tried to be as close to creative outlets as I possibly can through most of my life. But again, playing oboe professionally does not, it is not, one does not simply play oboe professionally. But I decided that that was not something that I could continue to do as a profession. And so I had to kind of step away from that as well. I was looking for some other creative outlet, and I found these card altars by Eric Klug and kind of got inspired by those and started doing my own. And I did that for quite a while. If you scroll all the way to the very beginning of my Twitter page, that is 3D altars. There are not, or sorry, that is 2D altars. I apologize. Mm. There are no 3D altars at the beginning of my Twitter account. However, one day when I was at a nearby local game store, it was not my regular store, but it was one a few miles further north of me. I stepped in off hours during a time that most people wouldn't normally be in a game store. And the person at the cash register was sitting on a booth chair, just kind of working away on a card on a cutting mat, just cutting into it with a craft knife. And I asked him, what on earth are you doing? Like, why would you do that to a piece of cardboard? Why would you do that to a magic card? And he says, oh, well, I'm making a 3D altar. And I asked him a few more questions, kind of what he does, what he's doing for it. And he said, oh, I'm making this for my girlfriend. I this is just kind of a fun thing that I saw online. And I asked him where he saw it online. And so we traded some information and he passed me the links to it. And I found a couple of articles and kind of took off from there. I just around this same time, the Command Zone made their creative process video episode, and I had seen that where and they had a call to action at the end of that episode asking people, you know, hey, if there's this creative thing that you've been wanting to do and haven't finished yet, do that, you know, go ahead and give it a shot. And that was enough push for me to try my first 3D altar, and it's kind of the rest is history, I suppose.
Brilliant. I mean, so the first 3D altar that I can see here on your pinned tweet is Saskia the Unyielding. Is that the first one that you did?
That's correct. I still own it here over at my desk.
It's really fantastic. So we will be doing a video version of this episode if you want to sort of see these card altars. But obviously, we're here on the audio in the present that you as the listener are listening to this. Lots of weird metaphysics going on. But looking at this Saskia the Unyielding, I mean, it's what really sticks out to me is that you didn't just stop at doing the 3D altering. You also like textured the rest of the card to make it look like muddy and battle-worn. Is that like, what was the inspiration there? Did you finish the altar and then decide to like carry on? Or like, what was your process doing your first 3D altar?
So much of what I do is just like on a whim, I guess I'm going to decide to do this a little bit differently this time. So let's see how it turns out. And I guess that one did work out well. It kind of springboarded me into a bit of a notoriety for making 3D altars that kind of try to push the boundaries a little bit in what 3D altars could be. Real quick, before kind of going a little further, can I explain what a 3D altar is, just in case anybody here doesn't, you know, listening doesn't know exactly what I'm talking about?
By all means, go ahead.
All right. So if you look at the artwork of a regular magic card, you'll see that the art has a bunch of different layers. It's got the foreground, it's got the middle ground, the background, a bunch of textures and layers throughout all of the artwork. My job, I suppose you could say, as a 3D alterist, is to take each layer of that artwork and cut it out into its own individual layer, and then cut every layer out like that, and then stack them together, texture those if appropriate, and create a diorama of the artwork on the card. That is at its most basic what I do as a 3D alterist. It goes way deeper and way more complex than that.
Hey,
as I'm
deeper.
Sure you can tell.
I like that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, looking at the process on some of these images, you can tell that there's obviously lots of like intricate sort of parts to a magic card. If you were to break down the artwork into the different sort of planes of depth, or maybe sort of, you know, just things like details on someone's bit of clothing, like how do you decide as the sort of artist looking at a painting that someone else has done? So like these are cards like have been, you know, painted by magic artists, and now you're trying to deconstruct it yourself. Like, how do you decide what needs to be, you know, in the background, in the foreground, what deserves its own layer? Like, how do you deconstruct these pictures?
Very conveniently, most of the artwork in Magic the Gathering these days is high realism fantasy artwork. Mm. And so a lot of that work is done for me, thankfully. It's just like in reality. I mean, I don't get to decide whether or not the computer that I'm looking at is in front of the wall that's behind it. So all I have to do as a 3D alterist is just find out which of these layers of artwork comes in the front, and then figure out how to make that work on what is ostensibly still a 2D space. I can't actually make a piece of cardboard 3D. It's still a flat surface. And so there's a lot of bending the rules, and kind of there are a lot of tricks that we use as 3D alterists to make certain things work. But it's all part of the process. But if it was just that, if it was just me looking at the artwork and saying, okay, well, what comes first? All right, well, I'll cut that out and then go from there until I get a diorama. I don't think I would get as much creative enjoyment out of it as I do. You had mentioned just at the beginning when we were asking, when we were talking about this, that like I also kind of made the rest of the art, the rest of the card look battle worn in Saskia the Unyielding. I guess when I first made Saskia, I finished the process of getting the card to the point where it was a diorama. And I said, this doesn't quite have enough. This doesn't quite feel finished to me.
Sure.
And it over a period of about 5 minutes, but I looked at it and went, what do I need to do more on this? Oh, you know what I could do? I could do that thing that a lot of people do on their Jeeps where they splatter mud across it. To make it look like it's been through a lot. Right.
Nice.
Yeah. And I guess I did. I just tossed a bunch of paint against the card and liked how it looked. And there it went.
God, that must have been a moment where you're like, well, I've basically finished with this, but you know what? I'll tell you what this needs. Splash of reckless paint on it.
Oh, yeah, my gosh. Well, that must have been a bit of a moment for you to think, right, well, I could just completely mess up however many hours of work I've put into this.
Oh, goodness. I've had so many moments like that where I look back and I say, if I made one wrong cut or one wrong splatter of paint across this piece, hours of work is ruined. I've learned since then that thinking about that too much would only lead me to decision paralysis, and I just have to go for it.
Yeah, of course, follow your gut. Yeah, no, I'm looking at some of the, like the layering here. There's little things like on pier where you deliberately lift off the clothing, because of course you would. Of course, the clothing's got an extra layer to it, so that makes sense. Or like say Ishkanah, where you're like, well, you could have just done like two planes, but no, every leg's got to be separate. Every leg has got to be layered. I think that kind of attention, whether it's obviously instinctive or not, I think that's obviously where the line of talent was, because God damn, mate. Some of these were fantastic.
Thank you.
You can definitely see the different processes that you've sort of taken over your time. And there must have been many different like little level up moments. I mean, whenever we sort of talk to artists and creatives, there always seems to be the sense of you have your craft, and whether it's something that's relatively new or something you've been doing for a long time, there's definitely these like individual moments where, like with your Saskia and Unyielding, where you think this is the next step to making what I do sort of different. But it just seems that for you, it's not just one moment. It seems to be many different ones. And it seems that every card has its own life. Like you look at something like Ishkana the Graph Widow, and it is like a diorama, as you say. And it seems to be, I mean, the quote unquote, the sort of traditional card alter way, if you can call it traditional, seeing as, you know, it's still such a new, fresh thing. But then you look at Pia Nalar, and you've done like an extended border with a raised card frame. So if from the top down, it would look like an extended card altar, like a 2D altar, until you kind of turn it and you can see all the different details. And then further still, when you go to Baron Von Count, or you go down to Curious Pair with your showcase, where you're starting to play with the literal depth of field and what the physical card as an object can do.
I love Curious Pair so much. Yeah. Sorry to interrupt, but
I mean, I was going to talk about Curious Pair.
Basking it, my friend.
Curious Pair, because this is the first one that I saw on the Magic the Flavoring Twitter, because it's like we're a relatively new podcast, especially on social media. We've only been around for about a year, so some of your earlier commissions, I don't think we had the network to sort of see them pop up. But Curious Pair was the first one that I think got shared by so many different people that I was following at the time. And it is just absolutely stunning. And this is, for me, I don't know, if I was to kind of guess, I would say this would be one of your kind of level up moments where you've taken the showcase. Yeah, you've taken the showcase of Curious Pair, and you've used the book sort of illustration on it, where it's the text box, and you've actually made them flow like the pages of a book physically above the rest of the card. And obviously then you have the depth in the illustration as well. I mean, can you talk to us about Curious Pair and about how that all kind of came together?
Absolutely. The moment I saw the showcase frame and artwork that was coming out of Eldraine as it was being previewed, I knew that I wanted to find one to alter for myself, just as a test of my own abilities, kind of legitimately. When I first started looking for a card to alter from those showcase pieces, it was as an attempt to test whether or not I could do it, because I saw all of the filigree of the vine work across the frame, and the book bending the pages. It looked so much more alive than, and I'm sure most people would agree that the Eldraine showcase frame is probably the best frame that they have ever made.
That's an objective viewpoint. I understand. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, it is a fact. Like they've nailed it with that showcase.
It is unbelievable.
I think we said a couple of episodes ago talking about showcases that we thought that one was.
It is the most evocative. The most. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
And so I needed, kind of as for my own creative advancement and edifice, to make a 3D altar of a showcase card. And then when I was looking through all of the artwork, I saw Curious Pair, and it just kind of clicked exactly what I wanted to do with it. It was this moment, like have you ever gotten a pet at an adoption clinic, and you just like are looking through all of the looking at all of the animals, and one of them just like looks back at you, and it's like, that's the one I'm bringing home. That was me with the Curious Pair showcase artwork. It was just like, that's the one that I'm doing. That's the one that I'm making.
Well, I guess it has a frame within a frame, doesn't it? So I imagine there are obviously things that your eye and your natural instinct will look for and go, oh, this is what I'm looking for. This is the depth that I want, or the number of, you know, the composition that I'm looking for to be able to alter.
Absolutely. I mean, on the video version of the podcast, I'm sure you'll have pictures of this coming up. But for anybody listening, the showcase artwork for Curious Pair shows two children obviously Hansel and Gretel or analogs of Hansel and Gretel walking up to a cabin, but we are looking at this from the perspective of the witches who are inside of the cabin. So you've got the witches with their hands crawling out from behind the frame, from underneath the, as if we were looking at this scene as the witch ourselves. And then we see skull candles and all kinds of other filigree and things inside the cabin. And then outside of the cabin, from the perspective of, we have a window in the center of this image, and there is a pie in the middle of the image with a bunch of cookies around it. And then from beyond that, we then get a couple of bushes and then trees in the forest, and Hansel and Gretel are standing there several feet away, looking at the pie. And with all of that, and then also the frame itself on top of that, where we have the vine work and the filigree and the book on the text, all of that coming together makes this card just look so much more alive and so much more complex and evocative than just about anything I'd ever seen before.
I was going to say, it does enhance kind of the layering effect that they already put into the picture that you might not necessarily know and notice. And when you do, as you say, deconstruct and pull all these out for individual inspection, it's then that you kind of get the full effect of everything that's within the picture that you probably didn't necessarily notice. You probably just looked at the border, went, oh, fancy border, and then moved on. Whereas, yeah, the hands and everything. Also, how many layers is that?
I used 17 copies of Curious Pear to make this card.
Wow. Did you have to decide how much depth you wanted to give them? Like you said, they were a few feet away. Yeah. So did you try going a little bit further? Or did you have a moment of where you had to kind of move them apart and see where you thought the depth of field worked best?
I absolutely did. So as I was building the card, one of the first things that I constructed, in fact, I think the first layer that I ever built, that I ever cut out, was the window itself. Because I knew that that would be kind of a key point in the creation of the card. Everything beyond the window needed to feel like it was still far enough away, but also not get lost in the depth. That's one of the tricks of doing a 3D altar properly, is just figuring out how deep you actually want all of the separation between the layers. You don't want it to go too far, and you also don't want it to be too close. You need to find this good balance between them. And it took me a while. I had to ask a few friends, my partner as well. They were very, very helpful. Eventually I found a good balance where it doesn't feel like it's too far away. It doesn't feel like the window is so far away from the card that you lose the feeling of Hansel and Gretel just being right there near, like it's as if they're making the decision whether or not they're going to take a bite.
You've got it off in that decision. If you make it too far away, they don't notice it. Yeah, no, I understand. The narrative in it, of course.
Absolutely. There is a narrative. Well, this is the whole thing. This is why, you know, this is why this game is so important to so many of us, is because these cards do tell a narrative, and these altars do seem to add that layer. No pun intended, Nathan.
Oh, dear.
I know you.
Always intended.
Immediately, my mouth went, oh, no, okay, he's got that fact.
It always adds this sort of extra thing to it. And there is something to be said for Curious Pear. I think one of the reasons it works so well is because of that perspective thing of you are one of the characters in the card art, even if that character isn't necessarily in shot.
Oh god, yeah. Can you imagine doing Village Cannibals with this style?
Well, do you know what? It's funny you say that, because that Bud Cook card is very similar to another card, which is Buried Alive, which is another altar that you've done, which is the 3-mana black sorcery, get 3 things into your graveyard. It's also a card which has made me think my Cathedral deck is maybe a little bit too oppressive.
Maybe that card's just a bit too
but I can't take it out. It's pivotal to the deck. I'm going to deconstruct the deck. But this is also another card where the artwork has you in the perspective of the viewer looking into the card. So having this, you know, this depth of field it is really kind of special, even for these cards, which, like Buried Alive, I think is the first card that we've just spoken about that isn't necessarily a creature card. So yeah, like the fact that you can do this without necessarily having like a subject, which is the kind of focal point of the card, if you like, and it is one of these kind of instances of sorceries that's more of a feeling, is pretty special. Another sort of aspect of this that I wanted to talk to you about and see if you have any thoughts other than, well, I just did it, which would be a valid answer as well, is the not only the kind of style of layering that you do seems to change up from sort of piece to piece, but also the kind of the amount of whimsy you kind of pump into it, or like maybe how what the card needs to become this 3D altar as opposed to what you, the artist, kind of puts on it. What I mean by that, is that you have card altars like, you know, PNLR and Ishkana, which are kind of, you know, very, very sort of relevant to them. But then you have another one, which is is it Infinity Elemental? Is that the uncard?
Absolutely.
Yes, that's the one. Yes, Infinity Elemental, where not only is an uncard, so obviously it already has this kind of idea of sort of gooniness or you know, whimsy, but that altar is not only 3D, it's actually like coming out of the card. So you have the figure of the Infinity Elemental with its limbs literally punching through the card art into the real world. Like, that's a massive step to take with your work, wasn't it? Like, how did that come about?
It absolutely was. This was another one where I mean this was pretty early on in my work doing 3D altars. I had just started about a year or so ago, done a couple of them, gotten one or two commissions from some people I'm very thankful for asking me about. I had not even considered doing commissions until somebody had asked me. And then Unstable came out, and it was just boom, boom, Baron Von Count and Infinity Elemental. I'm making these. And with Infinity Elemental, The moment I saw the artwork, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it. Again, it was just kind of this like click moment where it was, I knew I wanted to take the frame, the background of the card, which is the frame of the card spinning backwards into infinity. Mm. If you don't go look up Infinity Elemental, it's such a fun looking card.
Yeah, it's great.
But the elemental itself is kind of running out of this infinite spiral of infinity elemental frames and punching out into the real world. That's what it looks like it's doing in the card art. And so when I made the 3D altar, I decided I did not want to make the elemental itself out of cardboard. The elemental itself is sculpted.
Sculpted?
I did. I sculpted this the infinity elemental itself.
Wow, that's absolutely amazing. How is it binding to the cardboard itself? What's the process there?
There are a couple of posts holding it onto the card, and it's been glued and posted onto the card pretty securely. This has been jostled around quite a bit as I've moved around to different apartments, and it's held itself together quite nicely. But it is made out of wire framework with tin foil wrapped around that for all of the craggy rock face. And oddly enough, the rest of the sculpting was done with a hot glue gun.
Well, yeah, I guess it kind of works. Well, you can paint over all manner of sins, can't you? So
absolutely, yeah.
What I really love as well is that you didn't just stop there. You also had the text box itself kind of jumping out of the cardboard as well. So it's a raised text box at an angle to kind of give it that kind of squiffy look to it. It's absolutely fantastic.
Can I tell you a secret?
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's only going to be a secret to us until we release the episode to the world.
That was a mistake.
No, what?
That was a happy accident. Absolutely.
At an angle, and you're like, oh, this works.
As I was making the Infinity Elemental sculpture, the figure itself, I finished the sculpture and painted it, and then realized that as I had been sculpting and mounting the card, the leg bent and could not be corrected. The leg of the sculpture shifted in such a way that it was lower down on the framework of the card than it should have been. And I could not get it to fit back on so that the text box could go where it was supposed to go. And as I was sitting here racking my brain, trying to figure out what I could do, and I did not want to make another sculpture because I could have, but I really just, that was a lot of work already. And I got it right. And I didn't want to risk that happening again or going wrong in the second try. I suddenly had a thought and I realized that I could make the text box also rise off of the card as though this spin, the frames spinning down into infinity inside the artwork, was also kind of starting to rise off of the frame
coming
itself.
At you as well. Yeah, of course. This is it. Modern times require modern solutions.
Yeah. But I mean, the effect is perfect, and yeah. It's, you know, I mean, it's a kind of a cliched thing at this point that, you know, art doesn't always necessarily come from the best planned things, you know, but in this case it really works. There's a couple of other pieces I want to talk to you about before we move on to kind of more broader topics. And one of them is, I think it's fairly safe to say that this one is another one of your kind of level up moments. You can correct me if I'm wrong, of course. And that's Wheel of Sun and Moon. This card altar is absolutely incredible. And not only is it incredible in kind of the layers that you do, but this one is also like a functioning, moving card altar. So you've actually had the wheels of this moving with a battery pack in the back. Is it a converted clock? Is this how you've achieved this?
Yes. So Wheel of Sun and Moon is a clock. It doesn't tell time, but it does it. The both the space background that in the very, very center, if you look at the artwork on Wheel of Sun and Moon, there is kind of like there is some Celtic knot artwork spiraling into space in the very, very background. That image of the a galaxy, stars and space is rotating and ticking with the seconds of a clock. And the wheel and subsequently all of the Celtic knots and the spiral and all of that is ticking with the minute hand. So every hour, that entire circle with the two elves looking at each other and the sun and the moon on opposite of one another rotates fully.
I mean, that is just, it's such a clever idea and sort of a clever sort of solution, I guess, to how do you kind of make these card altars sort of even more different from one another. I know that you've also used a clock as a base for your Baron von Count card altar as well. But was that just to get the ticking sensation with the kind of sort of theme of the card, or it doesn't actually move, does it?
No, the clock doesn't actually move. I just, because the card ended up being so thick on Baron von Count, due to adding a sliding indicator so that I could actually show which number the Baron von Count doom counter was on. It ended up so thick that I just added a couple of extra, you know, little embellishments to the side of the card. So I added the clock from the Clock of Doom, another card in Unstable, onto the side of the card. That doesn't actually rotate or do anything. It's just a motif. It's just an embellishment onto the card. But Wheel of Sun and Moon absolutely did. I this card, right after I made Saskia the Unyielding, I fell in love so much with the idea of doing 3D altars that I had to do more. And I was looking around at other cards that I could make. And the first one that came up was Ishkanagraph Widow, because I was just looking through my collection and I had a copy of Ishkanagraph Widow, and I saw that card and needed to make a 3D altar of that. But also in the very back of my collection, with a bunch of other cards that I just have there to trade because I don't have any use for them, was a copy of Wheel of Sun and Moon. And I looked at that card and I said, this is some of the most technically complex artwork that I've ever seen from just a construction standpoint. It is incredibly detailed, complex artwork depicting a physical object. It looks like this thing, this wheel that was painted, is supposed to exist and is supposed to be a real thing. And the more that I looked at it, the more I realized, you know, this actually could be made. This could exist. This thing that Zoltan Boros and Gabor Ciskai created in the artwork could be a real piece of construction. And so this was like the third card that I ever decided to make. But Wheel of Sun and Moon is a $12 card, and you can't get 15 copies of a $12 card quickly or easily on my budget. So 3 years later, here I am making a Wheel of Sun and Moon 3D altar, finally, and I have so much more experience built up since then, since I first decided to make that altar. And again, just like Curious Pair, this was absolutely a level up moment for me. This was a hey, let's see if I can do this moment. And
well, two things from this. Like, one, you've managed to take something from Lorwyn and make it real when no one else has probably done so. But two, you've also bound Lorwyn to human time like a monster. No wonder the auras aren't happening anymore. That's fantastical metaphysics. But I mean, I just imagine in this pocket realm of a multiverse, like, yeah, like for some reason, that's why the aurora went up to buggery. It had nothing to do with Una. No, it's because Cthulhu got involved and decided to bind time together.
You might have found the most niche way to troll someone about something I think I've ever come across.
Man, that's amazing.
Oh, ridiculous.
It is fantastic.
It's absolutely amazing. And you seem to be kind of going now into the realm, because you said, yeah, your Baron von Count altar has a slider and also has a little dice tray at the bottom, I believe. Does that one have a dice tray, or is it just Buried Alive that has a dice tray?
Buried Alive and Baron von Count both have dice trays. There was also an altar that I did. I can never remember the name of the card. It's the king... the Sultai guy from Fate Reforged, Tassiger.
Oh, Tassiger, yeah.
Yeah, I also did a 3D altar of Tassiger that I made, that I put a dice tray into the bottom of. I love the idea of making these functional in some way, or some kind of showcase piece where the person who owns the card, the person who has the card, doesn't just have a fancy piece of artwork that they can put somewhere, but also has some kind of use for it, whether that just be that is their commander, or that it is a dice tray or something to hold something in, or that it has function and use within a game. I absolutely
even that interactive quality of Baron von Count's fantastic. The fact it serves a literal function as well as being, as you say, because obviously they can't necessarily, they're not so easy to bounce to hand and stuff like that. Obviously, I feel like with most of these, you go, well, we just put it back into the command zone, unless obviously you place, like, have a placeholder or something. But yeah, that interactivity, that fact that it's doing something active that it's supposed to be doing, obviously makes it much more engaging and is much more, you know, of an homage to the card itself.
Yeah, and it tells a story. Like, it continues to tell a story. And some of my favorite Magic cards are the ones that force you to physically play the game in a way that is evocative of what the fantasy world of the card is. Like anything like, you know, like Gamble or Chaos Warp, you know, those kind of red spells which they add the physical realm of randomness with a card that is meant to create a random effect. And you've taken that even further and applied it to cards that it was never, like, envisaged for. It's such a fantastic idea. Well, I think we're almost kind of running out of time, but there's something I want to kind of talk to you about as someone who is an artist and has to work with magic art in such a unique way, and maybe in a way that not many other people do. But as someone who stares at these art pieces for hours and hours on end and works with them, what is your sort of feeling on the kind of current state of magic art? Like, do you feel that we're entering a period where, you know, there was this idea of there was a lot of homogenization maybe about sort of like 4 or 5 years ago, that every Magic set kind of looked very similar to one another, and there was some slight criticisms, and now we seem to be getting into a realm where art directors are willing to kind of let artists have a bit more rope to do what they want to do. Like, do you feel like Magic art is going in a good direction? Do you have any concerns about it, or like, what's your general feeling?
The small questions, obviously.
Oh yeah, small questions, yeah, which you can answer in about 30 seconds, I'm sure.
Oh yeah, that's a real easy question. Let me take about 20 minutes and we'll get there eventually. I have, I guess this is what I could call a hot take about the artwork. I never really believed in the idea that Magic art was being homogenized in the first place.
Sure.
I think that is just a desire to go back to the way that Magic art looked back in 1993.
Sure.
Which I don't think is a very good idea.
Well, no, it had its own problems, didn't it?
It absolutely did. There's a lot of iconic artwork, and by iconic, I mean, well, it was definitely unique.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Infamous artwork.
Definitely. I feel that the high fantasy realism style of artwork, the majority of artwork in the Magic the Gathering game, is exactly where it wants to be. I feel like this is an intentional and very appropriate choice for the way that this game presents itself and the way that the game functions in the meta narrative that Magic the Gathering is trying to tell, if I can try to be fancy with my words. However, on top of that, I do think that these bits and pieces of really stylized artwork that are being done by the likes of Seb McKinnon or Zach Stella, who isn't quite as often mentioned, but does absolutely incredible stylized artwork. All of those little bits of hyper stylized, interesting artwork or abstract artwork are like bits of italics or punctuation in a poem or in a grand epic story. They exist for a very intentional purpose to draw uniqueness and interest towards them, so that the rest of the artwork, the rest of this high fantasy realistic artwork, can really sing the way that it's supposed to, the way that it feels like it's meant to. It's all, listen, I'm an art guy. I'm a music guy. I'm going to make a whole bunch of different metaphors, but it is a symphony in its own way, the way that all of the artwork works together, even when some bits of artwork are so vastly different than what it normally looks like these days to be a modern Magic card. That being said, all of those high, you know, stylized, weird pieces like the ones that Seb McKinnon does that are absolutely fabulous, I can't touch those as a 3D altarist.
that's already as much of a layer to put up. Well, I don't know, but Devil maybe. That's a lot of devils to cut out, though.
Sure. I mean, Seb McKinnon, like, is a very, like, his style is very flat, isn't it? Especially with some of his more, like, religious iconography that he uses. Like, that's got to be a bit of a headache to go after.
But I guess, yeah, with all these, I guess, as artwork gets, as, like, say, if you're talking about, like, artwork back in, like, the early 90s, everything, I guess artwork nowadays, if you have that hyperrealism, as you say, this idea of creating layered effects, that kind of thing, like especially digital artists, they can do a lot, which I guess for you in the way that you do your work would give you a lot more to work with. I don't know, there might be some artworks from back in the day that served to the same purpose, but I can see what you mean.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think your sentiments about how Magic art is going through is definitely how we feel here as well, that these showcase items and these kind of alternate arts are definitely nice to have there, because obviously we like variety and we like when things get pushed. But yeah, the game is one of the most recognizable and, you know, celebrated games on the planet, and there is definitely a good reason for that. So yeah, absolutely brilliant. Well, before we go, I have one last sort of mini subject to talk to you about, Keith, before we let you go, and that is Commander Cube. To move away from art, you let loose on us yesterday that you are a bit of a Commander Cube nut. Is that correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been going a little mad on Twitter recently, posting a bunch of different cards from my cube. I love making cubes. I had the first cube I ever made was just a pauper cube, and that kind of was pretty simple, pretty basic. It was mostly lifted off of another cube that somebody else had built online. But then I decided to make my own with an unstable and silver bordered cube, and that ended up being a huge project that I'm still working on and tweaking and tuning. And we get together, hopefully this year we'll be able to. I doubt we will, but some friends and I always get together every holiday in the winter and try to put together a couple of drafts of the silver bordered cube.
Nice.
But then I also have this Commander Cube, which was a project that I put together because I had too many Commander decks. I currently have about 24 Commander decks, and at the time I had around 30, and I decided that I had too many. So I broke down a bunch of them and said, I'm going to make a cube out of all of this. So I took apart my Artifacts deck. I took apart my Politics deck with Queen Marchesa and a few others, and took those and a bunch of cards from my collection that had been generically useful or fun or interesting, but never really found a home in a specific Commander deck that I had already built, and decided to kind of construct this Commander cube. This had all been in the works this had been in the works before the Game Nights Commander Cube episode with Brandon Sanderson. But
yeah,
once that episode came out, I absolutely loved the idea of the regalia and the way that it improved the draft aspect of the cube. And so I had a proxy artist friend of mine put together all of the regalia, as well as a couple of custom cards that I wanted for the cube. And this cube kind of came together slowly as this weird, unique thing. And the reason that I find it so fascinating or interesting or fun is because it's my love letter to Commander as the way that I want to build or play Commander. Full of a bunch of cards around 4 to 6 level on power that all just tell a fun story during the game. Like Duskmantle Seer, for example, is one of my favorite cards in the cube. It was the first mythic I ever opened back in Gatecrash. And Duskmantle Seer, just to let you know so you don't have to look it up, is a 4-mana. It's 2 generic, a blue and a black for a 4/4 with flying. And it says at the beginning of your upkeep, each player reveals the top card of their library, loses life equal to its converted mana cost, and puts that into their hand.
Yeah, party confident.
Bob. Yeah. The stories that can happen because of that card are much more valuable to me than whether or not you'll be able to get card advantage or card equity off of that effect, whether or not you're actually, because objectively you're not, you're losing card advantage by playing this card and allowing all three of your opponents to draw a card compared to your one.
Not deliberate if you put like a load of Eldrazi deliberate in the cube so they play them and then they flip them and then they lose the game because of it.
I kind of don't think you've got the spirit of this exercise.
Now. Maybe not. Don't get me wrong. I've been trying to create a cube for years, and I finally put the nail in the coffin when I went nope and threw away like 99% of my cards recently, my draft chaff and everything. But I like, I don't know, I'm getting to 22-ish decks, so maybe I'm not that far away from doing the same thing. Because I do feel the same thing. It's almost like a spirit of, like, I've got a couple of decks, like Merrin, for example, that, yeah, okay, I play Merrin, but I play Merrin from back when it first released, and it wasn't just when it was the new hotness, not that everyone's tired of playing against powerful Merrin, but I don't like bringing the deck up for that reason. But I do like the idea of retiring it and a few other decks that might, I've had too long, or just do something that everyone's used to, and doing this idea of like, well, let's expand it. Let's not just mean that I have to play this specific style. Let's make it so the entire format is playing with this kind of style. And you have some other options if you don't like that. You can do this kind of thing, but you almost like cultivate not only the deck you're playing, but you almost cultivate the entire game that you're playing and all the decks that are kind of going to be played within it. So I kind of like that. As someone who slowly but surely, one by one, got all of my friends to play Magic with my decks, you know, I like this idea of manipulating manipulating, that's a bad word, inviting and engaging my friends.
You use the word manipulate
that slipped, I'm sorry. I will retreat back to my hole and wait my turn again. Damn.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's very clear, Keith, that through not only your deck building and your work, that you're someone that really treasures the idea of storytelling within the game. And that is definitely something that we can relate to in a big, big way. I think we've just about run out of time. But before we go, where can people find you? Like, where's your work? Where can people interact with you? Like, where are you in the digital world, if not the physical one?
Currently, I am almost entirely on Twitter. I plan on fixing that very soon. I've got a website in the works, but it's not quite done yet, so I'm not going to plug it here. But mostly you can find me on Twitter. My tag is at Keithulu Cards. That's K-E-I-T-H-U-L-H-U, because I had to spell it correctly. Nobody spells it correctly, but no. I have to, apparently. And you can also find me there on that same tag on Instagram, where almost exclusively I use it to just post my most recent artwork. So don't expect me to post except more than once or twice every quarter, I would say, on Instagram. And then you can also find me on Keithulu Cards on Facebook, where I do basically the same thing. I only post when I have a new piece of art that I want to share or when commissions are open. So that's my social media and where you can find me.
Excellent. Well, we'll put all those links in the description box below, and you can find all of the cards that we've been speaking about today are in the pin posts on Cthulhu's Twitter, as well as there's a couple of other really cool threads that you've been doing. A recent one that you've been doing that I've been really excited by, and so is a lot of people, is you've been doing underrated cards from my Commander Cube as a whole thread. And I've seen this shared around by quite a few people, and there is an extensive list of some pretty gnarly looking cards. Like, they are very, very cool. So if you're interested in that, guys, please go check out Cthulhu's Twitter. Give him a follow as well. We would really appreciate it, because there is some awesome work. It's why we're talking to you today, because, like, obviously we love what you do. but yeah, other than that, guys, you can find us on Twitter at MTFlavoring. My personal Twitter is at AndyManface. Nathan's, yours is?
At the Fox in the Moon.
Emails go to mtflavoring@gmail.com. Cthulhu, thank you so much for coming on today and talking to us.
Thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
No. Pleasure's ours.
Well, yeah, 100%. All that remains for me to say then, guys, is thank you so much for listening. This has been Magic the Flavoring.
We'll see you soon.